we'll get into this. But what's interesting is that religion is also a social force in most of the in much of the history that teachers are required to cover, and in many ways that's skipped over. In general, if you talk to teachers, I talk to a lot of teachers about these issues, that teachers feel terribly unprepared and unsupported when it comes to teaching about religion, especially with that fear of controversy that's kind of in the back of people's heads, that teachers lack quality resources and quality professional development for teaching about issues of religion. I had an opportunity to reread all those textbooks that I don't work on in the last couple of days as before the talk to confirm what I thought, is that things haven't gotten a whole lot better in the last couple of years. I've spent time writing our own resources and not reading other people's, but I went back and this is not good, the resources that most teachers have to work with when talking about religion. And the bottom line, and I think we all know this in the room and sometimes we forget it, but the ability to navigate discussions about religion is really an essential civic skill. And it is really unacceptable that kids would go through schools and try to actually kind of compete. And we talked about civic knowledge and what are these civic competencies. This is an essential civic competency that's become actually more and more prominent, at least the need for it more and more prominent. And actually, I just haven't seen a whole lot of evidence that the teaching about this subject is getting a lot better. I will say that that for me, I thought much more seriously about this, like a lot of people who think of myself as a very secular person, on September 11, 2001, when I said, oh my God, these people did this in the name of God. And I'd heard about people talking about religion seriously, but I put it aside because I thought of myself as a secular person. That's really something different. That's something people talk about publicly in other parts of the country. You know, there are other issues about identity and membership that really matter. And I think that for a lot of people and a lot of educators, it was a wake-up moment. They said, you know, I'm not actually prepared to talk about this material. I haven't done my own reflection on it. I actually don't understand the basic concepts. I don't understand any core details. So I want to start doing this in as much of a casual way as possible by just telling you all a few stories. So I thought I'd start with a story actually of a guy whose archives are here at Boston College, a guy named Father Bullock. Bullock was a priest in Sharon, Massachusetts. Actually, he used to run the campus ministries in the late 60s around the Boston area. And he was actually the chairman of our board of trustees. And he always would come in and pick fights with me. He'd say, you don't take religion very seriously. You don't know anything about religion. No, y'all talk about issues of race, talk about issues of gender. You don't understand. This is a really big social force. And he said, and it's all you secular people. And so he said this actually the last time he and I talked about this was in a big group of people. And so everybody started talking about issues of religion, but it was absolutely sharing, swapping stories about their like least favorite Sunday school memory. You know, the rabbi that they didn't like, the priest who was really obnoxious, that nun who wasn't their favorite teacher. And he actually yelled at us. He said, grow up. Grow up. This is really serious. And if you can't look at this as a serious subject beyond your own personal experiences, what you're doing is reproducing the same thing that's going on in classrooms, where teachers talk about this material, but they talk about this without even realizing their own unconscious, you know, attitudes towards religion is trickling in everything that they teach, either avoiding the subject or not. And so there's actually interesting work being done by Diane Moore, who's at Harvard Divinity School and used to run a program. Diane and I like each other a lot. Diane did some interesting research. She's just collecting what people are teaching about religion. And it's interesting, while teaching about religion is really often required, people actually end up violating the law a lot of the time because their own sectarian biases end up getting in the way that they teach. So, you know, I'm introducing Buddhism. Well, it's kind of dumb. You know, is it coming out of the side of people's mouths? And they just have not had the chance, the professional development. I don't blame them. They've not been taught to talk about their own tradition, never mind other people's traditions. And yet they're supposed to be educating other people on this. And again, I don't blame teachers for this. So the evening before September 11, 2001, I was writing a book on the Armenian Genocide. And one of the things that you look at in the scholarship of this history is ridiculous, because either it's a completely secular story, you know, where the Young Turks are secularists, or that this is somehow being written as an Islamic jihad. And you cannot find people actually doing serious, for the most part, serious scholarship on this. So I was on the phone with a prominent scholar of this history from UCLA. It's like 4:30 September 10th, and, you know, he had to get off the phone. I said, but wait, before you get off the phone, you got to talk to me. How do I begin to understand the role of religion in this? And he said, you know what? This is really complicated. I just don't have time to talk to you about this right now. And then the next morning, obviously, were the attacks on September 11th, and then the conversation, I think, continued. And I said, I think it was all is a lot of wake-up call for a lot of people who entered this conversation from a very secular perspective. And my job used to work with a lot of the public in private and parochial schools in the area. And I started getting all these calls from teachers on the morning of the afternoon of September 11th. From the teacher saying, you've got to go get me a Muslim to come into my classroom. And I said, well, what do you want them to say? I don't care. Just get me a Muslim. And I started pushing. Well, what do you think that's going to happen? Well, they're going to talk about kind of the essentials of Islam. And that's going to help my kids understand what happened this morning. And it's a little more complicated than that. You know, it's a little more complicated than some essential of the tradition, right? You know, they wanted a what I actually found out is what people were looking for is they were looking for the imam, really, to come and give kind of the foundations of the tradition. I will say there's something positive. They also wanted a positive Muslim face in the classroom too. But in terms of content, it was a real kick. The teachers really didn't have a good sense of what to start with. They thought, let's just start with the basics of the tradition, and that's really what it's kind of backing up from what the textbooks do. If you look at the intro to world religions, where these are supposed to appear in the textbooks, the emphasis is always on ritual, not on lived lives. So what you're supposed to know about Islam is, you know, it's the five pillars of Islam. It's the noble truths of Buddhism. It's the sacraments. And that's in all the textbooks, and the chapter reviews will tell you that this is what you're supposed to be paying most attention to. Sometimes there's a nice little story in a text box, but for the most part, no. It's as if this religion has started and stopped and been unchanged forever. So,
I don't understand that last...
There is no sense of an evolution of traditions. The notion that traditions negotiate, they change. One of the great books I've been reading. I've actually just lost the rabbi's name, but I've been reading about the evolution of Jewish holidays, for example, and what a holiday would have been, you know, practiced, you know, in 70, you know, versus, you know, in the 70s. And they look different in different places in different times. There's a fabulous exhibition at the Jewish Museum of New York where they actually you walk into the permanent exhibition Culture and Continuity, and they have all these menorahs. And one of the really interesting things is when you look at the menorahs, there's some basic things a menorah is supposed to have, but what's in some ways the menorahs from these different places and times, which are behind in the case, are almost the most representational object of a particular society. Because the people who are practicing these traditions are also negotiating their lives in a community. So actually, the one menorah that really stuck out and I thought was incredibly ugly was one made in L.A. in the 1980s, and it was based on a piece of the freeway. So it had a ripple of the freeway. And so this is a negotiation between the tradition and the community.
So you're saying that religion is evolutionary.
Yeah.
It's not rigid.
Yeah. Well, actually, what I'm saying is, as a guy who's a wonderful speaker, who y'all look like have here, Abdullah Naim says, I think he has a fabulous quote. He said, there's no such thing as Christianity or Judaism in the abstract. Islam and Christianity and Judaism are what the believers make of them. They're what the believers believe and do. Religion is a resource, a powerful, profound resource that most people appreciate, but what they make of it, what moral, political, and economic actions they take, is a responsibility of the believers as they struggle with the scriptural or theological discourse. So these are negotiations. And yet when kids are supposed to do the introduction to world religion, you don't get a sense this is a negotiation. This is it. And this is what people believe, and therefore, the metaphor of kind of putting a car in overdrive all week has been in my head. It's that, you know, there are all these other social forces that influence people, but when they talk about religion in this particular case, it puts it in overdrive, and all those other social forces, apparently they just go away. You know? But that's not always the way it comes. So I would say that part of this is that we forget. We know a lot about what memberships in other groups are like. We know a lot about what does it mean to be a member of, you know, a male in a particular community and understand how that influences the way we live. But I think when it comes to talking about religion, we often forget a lot of that. And again, I think it often becomes essentialized in the questions that we might ask skeptically about other social groups, other social forces, I think we often dismiss here. While sometimes religion is overdrive, it's essentialized as a social force, as a way that we present it in the classroom. And it isn't to say, by the way, that there aren't things about a particular tradition in itself, right, that are, you know, part of the origins and the basics that aren't important to understand as motivators for people's behavior. I'm just saying it's just often reduced so much that we don't get the complexity. But other periods of history are secularized when religion is actually an incredible social force. And I could go on a list of a zillion of them. I was saying that I just listened to a great BBC documentary this morning in the shower about the Crusades. And really talking that this professor from Oxford was saying, you know, people were really obsessed with with sin in the society. That's not where I was going to go, but I thought I'd share this. People were really obsessed, and people had a sense that they were living in a pretty immoral time. And what does it mean when people are saying that you will be offered, you know, a path to forgiveness, participating in here? It's not the way that the textbooks talk about these issues. The religious conversation is often pushed off. People talk about this as economic gain economic opportunity. And this needs to be, we need to think about religion as a social force, in a serious one. So I think for me, the most obvious, glaring example of this is I was doing some work a few years ago on the American Civil Rights Movement. I had the honor of writing the study guide to the documentary Eyes on the Prize, which is a really cool, I was like, oh my God, I can quit now. And what is really interesting is I was working with teachers and our staff on this material, and how secularized this history is normally taught, and how secularized people's understanding are. And I mean, I don't need to go into a lot of detail because I think you get it really quickly. Is what is the SCLC? It's a Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The Southern Christian is not by accident. It's not an aside there. These are a group of ministers, Reverend King and Dr. King. And he's become only Dr. King. I mean, it's true that he used these titles interchangeably during his time, but his primary identification, his primary work, was a minister with a congregation. As a matter of fact, he felt very guilty for missing a number of services when he was doing other work. And the ministers that he worked with wove a very powerful narrative about the relationship between their story, their struggle, and Christianity, and Christian identity. And so why has religion been left out? Why did that get skipped over? So I thought I would just read a quote from King just to prove I'm right. So this is King on December 5th, 1955. I am not trained in the same speaking traditions that he was trained in, so he would deliver this better than I will. But let me try. We are not wrong in what we're doing. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. If we were wrong, Jesus of Nazareth was merely a utopian dreamer that never came down to earth. If we are wrong, justice is a lie, love has no meaning, and we are determined here in Montgomery to work and fight until justice runs down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. Who said that last line? Where would you? What's the source for the very last line? It's Amos. It's Amos. Yet on the King Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, it says, "Until justice runs down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream." Martin Luther King Jr. So, how can you understand the civil rights?
Period.
I mean, seriously, but a really common thing to do, and I think good teaching, we were talking about this earlier, is to start to look at the choices that people made, and why did people make these choices? Well, how do you understand the choices made by nonviolent activists? If you don't have some idea of a Christian, one particular Christian idea of redemptive suffering, right? If you don't understand this, nonviolence is a very skewed understanding of this tradition. It isn't to say it didn't motivate, other people were motivated differently, but the group of ministers that were at the core of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference really believed deeply in a particularly Christian idea of redemptive suffering. So if you believed in the beloved community, nonviolence was a way of life. This wasn't a choice that I made that like it would be for Malcolm X or Stokely Carmichael. Carmichael wrote very beautifully, actually, about nonviolence as a tactic. And if the tactic isn't working, I'm going to go try other things. That's a very different thing. And so people often, it's a really common teaching, right? When you take Martin Luther King and you take Malcolm X and you compare them. Well, if you don't understand how deeply embedded Christianity is in King's philosophy and his beliefs, you end up with this impression that a lot of kids walked away with, it pains me, where King becomes a coward because they're bending down and they're taking it versus the idea of bold action and fighting back. And you get a really bizarre understanding of this period. It's interesting because I have colleagues around the world. One of the things that a friend of mine has done some education in Egypt the last couple of years is how so deeply impressed kids are in Egypt by this Christian idea of nonviolence, because there's more comfort talking about the role of religion there. And what an interesting model of looking for Islamic sources actually to back this stuff up. So another history that I've done a lot of work with, and Facing History is primarily known, we do a lot of other things, but I think we're primarily known for our work looking at the rise of the Nazis and the Holocaust. And when you talk to teachers, and you work with teachers as we do on this material, one of the big frustrations I have is that for many, many teachers, they're terrified to talk about anti-Semitism. And I don't understand how you can talk about the Holocaust without talking about anti-Semitism. I don't know how you can talk about that without talking about the role of Christianity in part of this history. The church has actually been quite forthcoming. There was a statement we remember in 1998 that came out of the Vatican talking about anti-Judaism. And it's a tough struggle. But people have said this is stuff that's very, very important. But yet, when you talk to teachers, you say, God, I really don't want to come off as a bad guy. I really don't want to teach this stuff. And it's daunting, because what you're talking about is, you know, 1,000-plus years of history that kids have been taught and not taught this part of this tradition. And then do I have to go and reteach all this history? And I have a test coming, and I don't really know this history. I'm only supposed to teach World War II.
So why? What's the reason they give you for not wanting to do it?
So glad you asked. So what gets in the way? Lack of clarity about the law. What can I actually do into the classroom about with this material? Fear that if something controversial comes up, the administrators don't have their back, which is a big one. That actually should be number one. Fear that parent reactions. I don't know if I've had teachers mention this very specific line. That said, you remember the fights over Christopher Columbus? What if I get Jesus and Muhammad wrong? Lack of knowledge about the content. They don't get trained on this content. Lack of comfort with people's identities in relationship to the content. I've talked to both Jewish and Christian teachers about this particular issue. For a lot of Jewish teachers, it's actually very interesting. We just had this conversation in a very diverse group of staff members. A lot of Jewish teachers feel really like they don't want to be the one sharing this history, because they feel like they're sharing bad news. And, you know, say, well, what about other historical content? And they don't feel that way, but they haven't had a chance to think about it. And it takes, this is very tricky. It takes time to get comfortable here. So I think there's often fear of being seen as playing one religion against another in this history. This religion good in this time, this religion bad. I think that's true of the Crusades. I think it's true here. And kids really often don't know very much about their own religion, so never mind the religion of others. So your own starting point, you can't be sure of it. So I spent a week videotaping a teacher I worked with in New York. He's teaching about anti-Semitism, And he started with some quote from one of the early popes. And that girl raised her hand and said, "Why are you quoting the Pope and saying that this is about Christianity? Catholics aren't Christian." And he went, "Oh God." I wasn't really prepared to start there. I thought I could start here. And so what do you do? We spent a lot of time going, you have to stop now. And who's got the time?
What about a student saying, when you're talking about something, and you say, "Well, Jesus was a Jew."
No. I mean, absolutely.
No.
I mean, absolutely.
Honest to God, it's the truth.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And so what students have learned about their own tradition, it's often from a sectarian perspective, right? And probably not in relationship to other traditions unless they happen to be at a particularly progressive congregation. And that's unusual. So it's, I think, really challenging. And then you have the added pressure of testing time and accountability. You know, we talked about there's actually not a whole lot of testing on this particular content, so why actually teach it? Because that's not what's going to be in this state on the MCAS or in California on the California state assessments. And I know there are other things that I have to get to that will be on tests. So this is really a pain in the neck, and it takes time to do this right. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to turn to a clergy. And again, a lot of teachers do this, and the clergy, again, are so often not prepared to either work with students, talk about their own tradition to people who aren't members of their tradition. There have been a few who have been exceptional. Father Bullock, who I mentioned before, happened to be exceptional. But that's not part of typical training for a member of the clergy. They do their job, which is teach about their own tradition to followers of their tradition. That's their job. So teachers then can say, "Well, this is a sidebar anyway. Most textbooks don't ask you to talk about this stuff. It's a side story. It makes me anxious. I'm just going to let it go." So without all of this, you end up with, and I really believe this, ignorance, myth, and misinformation. I don't think I'm overstating it. You know, so, you know, it's a cliche here, but globalization is really bringing us into encounters with people of different traditions in ways that we've just not been before. I know it's a cliche, but whether it's actually in the room or whether it's online and reading about somebody else's tradition in a newspaper or a blog, oh wait, I didn't know that about those people. And how do you start to critically evaluate what you're reading? And it's, I mean, without going to the extreme, it is really interesting if you map hate crime data. Hate crimes happen in communities where there's new diversity. It's typically not in communities where there's long time living together. That's all, we're together, I don't know much about you, I may not want you here. So, and yet this is people coming together more and more, whether they like it or not. So avoidance means kids lack the essential civic skills and the ability to decode the world around them. So, I mean, I could go to a number of situations, but recently, whether it's the cartoon crisis or other things, where all of a sudden people find words or images matter more than they ever kind of assumed that they would, and people aren't prepared to understand that. My son was on a soccer team a couple years ago in Brooklyn, and he had Muslims, Jews, Hindus on the soccer team, Christians, a couple Buddhists on the soccer team.
Some secularists?
Yeah, probably some secularists. My kid. and the team was the Crusaders. One of the parents didn't like it. You know, I agreed with them, but it's like, do you go and say something? If I go say something, I'm a pain in the neck. And then, you know, those people have a problem. And they just, there's always a problem with those folks. So that's a big deal. So how can students, if you're not talking about this, challenge some of the simplistic narratives, you know, about, you know, this religion is always this way, and our religion is always this way. You just, you can't. So I want to start end with a couple stories. One quick one from Europe. There's a guy named Ed Hussein. Ed runs the Quillen Foundation and wrote a book called The Islamist, which is an interesting book, actually, about, I would say, his story out of radicalization. A lot of people talk about his story, what led him to become radicalized in Europe. It's really about what led him away from radicalization. But Ed's first chapter is full of two particular memories in school. One is he went to an Anglican school on the east side of in the east side of London, and they shared, and kids were supposed to set the table. And one day, he forgot. It was his job, and so he gets yelled at, and the teacher's really letting him have it. And he says, "Where's your Allah today? Where's your Allah today?" And I said, he's just trembling, because this is the teacher, this is the authority figure. And he remembers another moment where there was he's playing in the schoolyard, and they're playing on concrete, and he ends up smashing his head, and he's bleeding. And the teacher, another Christian woman, takes him on his shoulders and runs him to the emergency room. And he just, in the stories for him, were this reminder, you know, of just the power that teachers have in setting the climate, you know, for young kids. Do you belong or don't you belong? And so Ed took an interesting journey that actually was deeply influenced. I don't want to essentialize these choices, but became a really dangerous radical, Ed, for a very long time. But is also somebody who spent a lot of his time in recent years really just trying to help kids who feel on the outside understand that you're British. And you can claim Britishness. Absamad Massawi is French, and he has more horrible stories, actually, of what it was like for him to go to French schools in the 80s, in the 90s. His brother, Zacharias, was the 20th hijacker, and he wrote a really powerful memoir, actually. But he talks about this, and he says, you know, in such situations, a child does not really understand what's happening to him. He doesn't know why people are nasty. So when he grows up, he learns not to let it get to him. He learns, instead, to use his fists. And when he can lash out, he lashes out. And so for the climate to change, for civic literacy to change, teachers desperately need quality resources, desperately need professional development. I think that I can end there. I really thought maybe this is just a little bit of a food for thought for a conversation. I will say that I'm speaking at 35,000, you know, what is it, foot altitude here, because I just wanted to set a picture, and I think we can have a conversation, and I do think that other places, it's not always like this.